Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to our study of Peter Crave's Christianity for Modern Pagans. We are critiquing human reason today in its fallen state, especially under the heading Vanity or Emptiness of Human Reason. So we picked this up by way of introduction last week, and maybe just to highlight one of the more important points in Crave's introduction, we'd go to the very bottom of page 96, where Crave writes, "Reason's ladder is far thinner today because of what happened in Pascal's day under Bacon, Descartes, and the Great Darkness, universally misnamed the Enlightenment. Reason narrowed from wisdom to science, from understanding to calculation, from exploring mysteries to solving problems." And we can see that in the world all around us, driving our entire American paradigm, and why it is that we have no one giving us great insights into theology and human nature, but producing all kinds of new iPhones and gadgets and devices. So we have gone from exploring mysteries to solving problems. So this already shows a kind of inferiority or fallenness of human reason. It is simply, and especially after the Enlightenment, no longer up to the task, not even attempting the task of theology. It's never been up to the task, but now it's no longer even attempting it. Okay, so we'll jump in with Ponce 410, but first let's have our invocation and prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit,
amen.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. All right, so Ponce 410, page 97. This internal war of reason against the passions has made those who wanted peace split into two sects. Some wanted to renounce passions and become gods. Others wanted to renounce reason and become brute beasts. But neither side has succeeded, and reason always remains to denounce the baseness and injustice of the passions and to disturb the peace of those who surrender to them. And the passions are always alive in those who want to renounce them. All right, so using this kind of thought paradigm, reason against the passions, do you think our society more on the whole represents reason or the passions? Does it more on the whole show the desire to become gods or the desire to become like brute beasts? What do you
passions.
Think? What's that?
Passions.
Yeah, I think so too. Passions and the desire to be brute beasts. In fact, that's the explanatory power of the theory of evolution. Well, that's our origin. We're just animals, after all. So when we act like animals, then we're just acting in accordance with our nature. And so then evolution becomes more than just a narrative of origin and becomes an actual gospel. Because your comfort that you are the way you are is that it's natural and it could be no other. And so in this fallen religion, the reason why you so tenaciously cling to this idea that my uncle was a primate is you want to behave like an animal, and that gives you carte blanche to do so. It gives you your whole narrative in which you can operate in the language of Pascal according to the passions. Okay, can you think of any movements, whether within the modern sphere or ancient, can you think of any movements where it's the opposite extreme? Reason, complete denial of passions entirely, and the desire to become as gods, as opposed to recognize. Yes, sir.
What do you think? Or Hinduism, perhaps?
Okay, so Buddhism or Hinduism would not be a bad answer at all.
To oneself, right?
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. That, yeah, and maybe akin to that, forms of stoicism where feeling is really the problem, or desire or disappointment when desire isn't met is really the problem per se. So this emptying. Gnosticism is probably the low-hanging fruit too, where you've got the denial of the self or the material body, and the assertion that the soul or the inner you is the real you, and that you are utterly rejecting your creatureliness. Okay, so that gives us some idea, but obviously I think today our problem is the passions and the animalistic side of things. Let's take a look at what Kraft has to... Yes, sir.
I'm not sure there's a clean-cut distinction among many people today. I think the people that are leaning on the animalistic side of things haven't thought things through clearly in terms of their own survivability. They say, oh, we should all be able to do what we want. Well, that's just pure survival of the fittest. And those that are saying we want to just do what we want are not really in a position physically or financially to be on top of the kingdom. They're going to find themselves quickly subjugated, and then they'll quickly want order once again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a kind of immature and naive little pocket of history and of culture where the people who live most according to their passions and their animalistic desires are protected by those who tend not to. But if they ever succeed in overthrowing that protection, then they're going to find out real fast. Yeah, that's kind of the... But that pattern, I think, repeats throughout history. Okay, good observation. Thank you. So, Kraft's commentary at the bottom of 97, Freud was far from being the first to discover the weakness of reason and the power of passion. Let's see if I can dust this off in my mind. You remember Freud's schema? It was the id, that's the base desires, the seat of the passions, and then the ego and the superego. And the ego is kind of mediating between these two, and the superego is the one that's holding on to the principles and the higher self, the higher motivations or inclinations. Okay, so the observation here is that Freud was far from being the first to discover the weakness of reason and the power of passion. That is, that this id and or subconscious drives and motivates so much within us. Kraft continues, he, Freud, saw the impossibility of living the Platonic and Stoic philosophy, which says the war can be won by reason. What Freud failed to see was the impossibility of living his own animalistic philosophy, which says that the war can be won only by passion, and that we can overcome the guilt that arises from the reason. Pascal pulls no punches in labeling all such philosophies, like those of Hobbes, Marx, Darwin, and Skinner, ones that, quote, wanted us to renounce reason and become brute beasts. All right. Now, tying this in with the preceding chapter, like the war between might and right. And I'm not so sure it's a direct kind of, or call, yeah, I don't know. It's right, the analogy is true in some ways and not true in others. That's what I'm trying to say. Like the war between might and right, the war between reason and passion can never end this side of heaven. The materialists and the spiritualists, the animalists and the angelists are all dreamers. Pascal is the realist. The fact that we cannot renounce passions does not mean, however, that we cannot control, direct, or ride them like wild horses or bonsai pipeline waves. We cannot dry up the waves, nor can we build on them, but we can learn to surf on them. We cannot renounce our passions, nor can we live on the basis of passion, but we can ride them. But no surfer can avoid all wipeouts. Okay, so an important point here that by passions we really are talking about desires, and God creates, I mean, even though this is somewhat hypothetical in our minds or theoretical in our minds, this idea that God created Adam and Eve with certain desires, those desires were all rightly ordered. And so what happens on account of the fall is that those desires become disordered. And so in that sense, passion and desire are the same thing. God creates mankind with certain passions or desires, even the base ones like I desire to eat or I desire to sleep. As far as we know, at least the food Adam and Eve would have had, the sleep probably as well. These are natural and well-ordered and in harmony and as they should be. But what we see after the fall is that these things go awry. And so in every aspect of the life of desire, it's always too much, too little, wrong time, and so on and so forth. You have the energy, but not the money, but not the energy, the time, and neither of the two. Preceding or the two preceding and not the time. Everything is disordered and our desires themselves are disordered. Okay, so you obviously can't remove passions and you can't remove them, I mean, in a sense, not only because of their power, the disordering power, you can't cease from sinning. But also, and more importantly, because the passions or desires are simply part of your creatureliness, part of what God created and designed. So that's maybe the take-home point from this last paragraph here. All right, any thoughts or reflections? I mean, again, we're still building the case. We're going puzzle piece by puzzle piece here. We haven't reached any conclusion as of yet, but any reflections so far? Yes, sir.
Just real briefly, I think you already touched on it just now, but passions aren't necessarily bad, right? They are part of our creatureliness.
Right.
It's the disordered passions that are a problem, right?
Yes.
I guess in the same way that reason isn't inherently bad, but A, flawed reason, or B, a wrong use of reason is bad.
Yes, exactly right. It applies pretty universally to human characteristics. Like in our age, I mean, you need a certain amount of ambition or motivation or drive. And if you lack that, that becomes an issue unto itself. You become apathetic, listless, nihilistic, a drain on your family and or society. So you need a certain amount of ambition, but obviously you can think of ambition gone awry, where now you're throwing everything and everyone under the bus of your success, and you're willing to be unscrupulous and do whatever it takes in order to succeed, quote unquote. And as soon as you succeed, you realize there's yet another horizon, and it's just this nonstop destructive drive, probably like most CEOs in the world have. But that those are two poles exposing the problem. You have to have ambition, but you have to have it in balance with checks and limitations. Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the strangest things that we have, I don't know if it's a passion or not, is the desire to live. Just the will to live. People will fight death.
I think it's a great example.
Until, you know, forever. And the drive that we get from that is mostly positive, I think.
Yeah. So if you don't have the passion to live, what does that look like? Well, at worst, suicide, but then various slow forms of suicide or complete disregard for oneself, one's body. And so it's just, reckless, nihilistic, self-destructive. There's even an element in some sins that are self-destructive. They're self-hating, self-loathing sins. So that's one side of the coin if you don't have that passion to live. But as you're articulating, just like with ambition, if that passion goes without check or balance, you have people doing all sorts of absurd things that borderline on the completely religious and superstitious. You know, if I eat X amount of greens every single day, if I work out this much, not 1 second less or 1 second more, but this much precisely, now right? And it's just this entire religious schema, almost down to Pharisaical details of how one's going to prolong one's life. And then, of course, just this idea that we see when people have rejected Christ, they cling to life like no other. I mean, they'll pay any expense, they'll go through any amount of indignity, they'll anything. I mean, we saw this in COVID at a corporate level. You know, the entire world has to shut down unless half a percentage of us dies. It's wild if you think about it. So, I think that's a great example. And one of the deeper passions or desires of okay, so just what's the Christian answer to that? We want to be good stewards of our life. God has given us life, and we're here for a purpose. And we want that balanced, God-pleasing life. And yet, when it's our time to go, it's our time to go. So it puts you in this pleasant middle ground, even if it doesn't have tight limits or even if it isn't easily defined, we find ourselves in this median space of saying, I want to be a good steward of my body and life and health. I'm not falling into self-destruction or nihilism. But on the other hand, I don't value my life much either. I'm completely in accord with Christ's word that whoever loses his life for my sake will gain it. So like St. Paul, count myself already dead to this world and alive to God in Christ. So it's that kind of balance that we have as Christians. So now you can see, too, that Christianity, the fruits of Christianity, even bear itself out in good psychology and in mental health and well-being, where the spiritual and the psychological health converge. Yes, sir.
Oh, I was just going to say, have you seen the guy who makes it his whole life mission? Have any of you seen him? He's made it his whole life mission to live like as long as possible. And he actually looks like unhealthy, like almost too healthy. And I don't know how old he is. He's maybe in his 50s now, but it's like every waking moment is consumed by trying to live longer. And it's like, well, are you actually living if you spend every moment making sure that you live?
Right.
But I mean, it also reminds me, like, can we do anything to stop the onslaught of death? Like, no. Yeah, like, right. It's coming. We're temporary. We're sojourners, you know? And it just reminded me of that.
It's great. Thank you for that example. Yeah. What a perfect icon of what we're talking about. I mean, and you brought up the kind of paradox. It's like every kid knows this at some level. If you go to bed, you'll live longer and enjoy life more. Yeah, but I'm asleep for the difference. you'll live longer if you eat nothing but vegetables. Is that really how you want to live? Yeah. No. Okay, yes, I thought I saw it. Yes, please.
I think this is something, if you start addressing some of your passions and you commit yourself to sinning less and really kind of examining yourself according to the Ten Commandments, the challenge starts to come in on step by step. How do you actually do that? Because, the evangelicals tend to go too far with come to my seminar and I'll teach you step by step how to eat correctly or sinless or reduce your sins. But when you're just kind of a free-range Christian and you're asking God for help and seeking guidance from his word, mm-hmm. it's not so clearly defined. Because the minute that you say, okay, I'm going to go to church every Sunday, mm-hmm. you know the powers of hell are unleashed to get you to not come. Mm-hmm. And it's not just your own sinfulness that says, ah, you're too busy, or you can go next week. It's supernatural forces at work too. So with regard to what we're talking about here, we're told to sin less. We're told to practice piety and fast and do what you can. But if someone's not actually teaching you how to do it, you're just kind of, you can fall into what we're discussing here, mm-hmm. piety or despair.
Yeah, that's true. And it's also true, I mean, I don't think it's so simple, but if we just make it so simple for the sake of our conversation, if you thought of sanctification itself as a kind of passion, then think of the lawless in our midst who say, I don't want to be sanctified, and I think the attempt to be sanctified is self-justification, and I prove my Christian superiority by not living like a Christian. So that would be one side, but then what would the opposite error of that be? What would be the example of the ambition unchecked? What would be sanctification unchecked? And probably it is this being consumed with self-measurement and tangible ways in which you've quote unquote improved, and forgetting any sense of the relativism for your season of life or where you are at or what your circumstances are, right? So as with the other passions, if we think of the desire, the passion to become more spiritually mature, to grow in faith and love and the theological virtues, as the scriptures would have us do, we can think of these two ditches that we can fall into. So on an analogy here would be something like physical fitness over the course of your whole life, because we're talking about spiritual fitness over the course of your whole life. So as you pursue physical fitness over the course of your whole life, you're going to recognize that there's going to be good times and bad times. There's going to be steps forward and steps back, and there's going to be setbacks from which you have to dig out. But maybe if you were to come to a rule, the closest rule you could come to is just show up. Just be consistent with whatever you're doing. That's going to put you on the long run in a better place than any flash in the pan heroics. And so then by analogy, that would be like what St. Paul is talking about, where he's talking about maturing as a Christian, no longer being children, no longer being earthly minded, but spiritually minded. Growing and maturing into the image of the mature man, Christ Jesus our Lord. So that would look more like someone who is interested in being physically fit from their youth all the way to the end of their life. That how that is practiced is going to change as they themselves change, but consistent things will be like self-discipline, like putting one foot in front of the other, like neither giving up nor going into, I mean, it's like the bipolar thing, right? Neither giving up nor going into manic phases. Being concerned when the manic phase hits is just as you would be concerned when the opposite hits, and just saying, okay, I need to bring it back to that balance, whatever that may be. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. As you can see, it's a really helpful thought paradigm, this idea of passions and the balance of the passions. So, yeah, it's fruitful. Okay, did I see another hand? Is there another? All right, good. So, jumping back into the text then, we're on Ponce 21, page 98. Here's, I think, kind of recognizable Ponce. If we are too young, our judgment is impaired, just as it is if we are too old. Now, it is a rare and humble human being who can say, I recognize that in my age, my judgment is not what it once was. That is, I don't know how rare that is. The Lord knows. Could there be one or two people walking the face of the earth right now who hold to this? I don't know. All right. So there's a kind of paradox. I mean, it's an observation. On both ends of life, judgment is impaired. He continues. Okay, so what, I mean, already you can see how that factors into the vanity of reason. And you can even see, by way of my reflection, that even reason itself is incapable of seeing when it's lost or seeing when it's diminished. Okay, Pascal continues, thinking too little about things or thinking too much both make us obstinate and fanatical. Okay, and he's not against certitude. He's not against truth. He's not against defending the truth. That should all be obvious. But the idea of being obstinate and fanatical goes a step further. So we can recognize this observation that it is precisely the people who are overly consumed with things who become way too strong in their opinions and are willing to go to absurd lengths to enforce them. And the same paradoxically is true with those who know virtually nothing about a thing. Okay. Pascal continues, if we look at our work immediately after completing it, we are still too involved. If too long afterwards, we cannot pick up the thread again. So here are, again, he's just kind of exploring these paradoxes and the limitations, weaknesses, inconsistencies of the phenomenon of reason. Okay, so if you're too involved, maybe you've had this experience, you can't objectively tell if it's good or bad, if it's true or false, you're just in it. And then likewise, if you take too long away from your thought and you go, well, I can't even follow. I don't even know what I was thinking. So that just shows that reason over time is inconsistent and affected by its proximity to the thing that it is analyzing. Okay, Pascal continues, it is like looking at pictures which are too near or too far away. There is just one indivisible point which is the right place. So there you can see his reflection on the middle ground, like we were talking about in our previous conversation about the passions. So as with sight, you can be too near and can't see, or too far and can't see. So also with reason, getting too closer into something has a distorting effect, just as being too far away from it has reason can't grasp anything or any part of it. So there's this middle point, this one indivisible point, which is the right place. All right, and then Pascal says, others are too near, too far, too high, or too low. In painting, the rules of perspective decide it, but how will it be decided when it comes to truth and morality? Now that is a really big question, because then it's going to say that reason is necessarily going to fail to objectively come to truth or proper morality. And in fact, it's going to fail much more often than it succeeds, and its success will be relative. Okay, so, I mean, some fun observations here, but a pretty indicting pensée against the sufficiency of reason, or even the reliability of reason, when it comes to these higher things. Okay, so Kraft comes and says, human reason is not invalid but weak. Ideal reason, purely objective reason, divine reason, reason essential, is not so weak that it can know truth only through a tiny narrow window. But human reason is like human eyesight. Only a narrow range of color is visible to it. All extremes are invisible to the eye and incomprehensible to the mind. As the last line shows, the situation is not critical in sensory or aesthetic realms, but in morality it is crucial and tragic, especially in our age of moral relativism. And you remember in the preceding chapter, the vanity of justice, it's like every culture on earth has existed with some form of injustice, or made legal things that are immoral, or made illegal things that are quite moral. Okay, so that's in view again here. Let me see if you have any thoughts on that that you want to reflect on. Okay, so we'll just keep tracking with the argument. On say 542, thoughts come at random and go at random. No device for holding on to them or for having them. And that's even true of your word processor or your notepad. How many times have you written something down and you come back to it and you're like, what on earth? Like, what does that have to do with anything? Okay, so last line here, a thought has escaped. I was trying to write it down. Instead, I write that it has escaped me. So good. So here's, again, the vanity of human reason. It's completely unstable. It comes and it goes. And it seems to be somewhat in our control. Like when you tell a kid, you know, well, think harder. Or you have to think about it, you say to an adult. So in some respects, thinking is within our control and within our will and ability and exertion. But in other cases, it's not. And sometimes it eludes us. Sometimes no sooner than you have this wonderful realization, you suddenly can't remember it. So reason or experience in this way tells us that reason itself is not as stable as we would like to think it is, especially if we were to use it as the tool by which we're going to discern truth and morality. Okay, this is great. Plato compared the mind to an aviary and thoughts to birds. And it's funny because Luther does the same thing. We have only a little control over them. Reach for one and you may scare it away and get another. The highest and most godlike thing in us, that which understands eternal truth, is subjected to the lowest things in us, random chance, which neither understands nor is understood. This is more evidence for the fall, another example of our looking suspiciously like disinherited princes. The fact that we are used to the fact that blind molecules bumping into each other condition our thoughts to be or not to be, to be thoughts of this or thoughts of that, makes our condition more, not less, wretched. The fact that we do not see our weakness is our deepest weakness. Right, and I don't understand this. Like the thought life, the intellectual life, if that's not grounded in God, and if your referent isn't in the idea of God, I don't understand how people don't go insane. Why am I thinking what I'm thinking right now and not thinking another thing? And should I be thinking another thing? If I didn't have God, I'd probably already be in an asylum. Well, how are your thoughts grounded if not oriented toward God? It's like saying, like, how does my physical existence, how do I have any bearings if gravity isn't pulling me to the earth, or if I can't see a horizon? Like, it's just, you're completely free-falling, and mentally you're free-falling if you don't recognize your thoughts are a converse with God. Okay. So in any case, the last line here is the most important, the fact that we do not see our weakness, that reason doesn't even understand that it's unreasonable, is our deepest weakness, our greatest blindness, our greatest irrationality. So, of course, this Plato's idea of the thoughts, the mind being like an aviary and the thoughts like birds. You remember Luther's, like, I think he says, maybe somebody else before Luther said it, but it became popular to us through him. That's, you can't prevent thoughts from flying overhead, but you can prevent them from building a nest in your hair. So,
I just heard that yesterday.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So it's good. It's good, especially with temptations and sins and that kind of thing. Like, you can't stop the temptation from flying overhead, but you can stop it from building a nest in your hair and taking up permanent residence within you. Right? Yes, sir.
There's been a lot written and discussed on how more and more people today are having difficulty reading, especially challenging books, and they're blaming it all on computers and phones, and we have too many distractions, and instant gratification is the cause of all this. Because we want instant gratification, we can't read a book to its end. But now in reading this, I'm wondering, maybe there's some other reason, because Pascal did not have social media and phones and computers, and he's describing the way I think of things sometimes. I can't focus, and it's this endless search for daily planners and organizers to help me focus and get my stuff done.
Right.
You know, so maybe there's some other reason. I don't know.
Yeah. I know you're exactly right. Yeah.
You know, I think you can reason things any way you want to reason. Reason them, you know. But I think today in this society, what we lack is common sense. And I think everyone should have some kind of common sense, but I don't see it in this society today.
Yeah.
They reason out things that are just oblique. They're not something that is. Well, the reason is not reasonable.
Yeah, lots of different ways that maybe we could describe how that happens or how that seems to have come to such a head in our society. I think to some degree or other, people have always complained about the lack of common sense. But in our society, I can't help but think that there's very rarely immediate consequence the way there is in a real world. Our society has created conditions that aren't like the real world, a kind of bubble or pocket where you can get away with a lack of common sense, much more than you could apart from a society like ours.
What is common sense?
It's a great question. I think that this would go back to his point that we began the class with. So this was on the bottom of 96, page 96, and the top of 97. So he says, reason, that's the last word on 96, narrowed from wisdom to science. So I think common sense is a form of wisdom. And in that sense, it is, it's not ever less than reason, but it is more than reason. So that's why it's not common reason, but common sense, a common meaning, a common wisdom, a common outlook. So maybe that's as close as we can get to, and I understand that's pretty nebulous still, but in our day it's probably even narrowed more down to science, you know. And of course this ridiculous canard, I follow the science. You mean the scientific method? No, I mean just what people in white jackets tell me. complete religion. But that idea of wisdom or intellect or knowledge narrowed down to science, or narrowed down to reason itself, or narrowed down more likely to what works, pragmatism. So, like, common sense would be well beyond mere pragmatism. Like, the pragmatic might be, I'm going to rip this guy off and he's going to have no recourse. But common sense says, I don't want to live in a world like that. I don't want other people to do that to me. And you don't even have to be a Christian to have that level of common sense, right? So maybe that's the best I can do, but it's a great question. Okay. That takes us through Ponce 542. Any other thoughts there before we move on? Okay, a lengthier Ponce, so we're going to do just a little bit of jumping to the commentary while we're in the middle of it here. Ponce 21, for we must make no mistake about ourselves, we are as much automaton as mind. As a result, demonstration is not the only instrument for convincing us. How few things can be demonstrated. Proofs only convince the mind. Habit provides the strongest proofs and those that are most believed. So by habit, he's going to talk about, like, this is going to become recurring experience. Okay, it's going to be more powerful to us than pure raw reason. So proofs only convince the mind. Habit provides the strongest proofs. And habit here is going to be other than reason, other than the mind. And the point of that being then that the mind is weaker than the habit, so the vanity of human reason. We think it's the highest. We think we're rational, but in fact we're not. And in fact we're driven, our intellectual life is driven much more by habitual observation than it is by raw, pure reason. Okay, so habit provides the strongest proofs and those that are most believed. It inclines the automaton, which leads the mind unconsciously along with it. Okay, so the mind is led along with the automaton. The automaton is led along by habit or by recurring, the experience of recurring phenomena. So let's see what Crafe says on A over on page 100. Pascal was not a determinist, behaviorist, mechanist, or materialist. We are not only automaton or essentially automaton. But our, and yeah, I think you know what that means. But our reason is so weak that it needs help from habit. Habit moves us much more effectively than reason. There is almost nothing people cannot be habituated, almost hypnotized into accepting. Genocide, slavery, infanticide, abortion, sodomy, suicide. Okay, so if you lived in a world or even a country where there was no such thing as abortion, abortion would strike you with horror and terror and a visceral, like, gut feeling. Usually we have to kind of work ourselves into that because we're so accustomed to it that you have to actually think about it. Somebody says abortion, it's like, okay, yeah. But you have to actually think about it in order to get that sort of visceral disgust reaction. So habit has already dominated and taken over in that respect, and in other respects as well. I mean, people in our culture don't think anything about it. And then the same would be true with these other things, but we could just use that for an example. I mean, sodomy is another one where it's naturally disgusting, but because we become so habituated to it, it's no longer disgusting to us at a visceral level. Again, unless you really think about it, which who wants to do that? So, in any case, these are proofs that habituation is more powerful than reason, especially in the experiential effects of our daily perceptions. Okay, I'm going to just keep like powering on until we get through the whole of this, and then we'll do whatever reflecting we need to, because he's not done with the argument, obviously. So back over to page 99, and we're on the fourth line from the bottom, right after that superscript A. Pascal writes, "Whoever proved that it will dawn tomorrow and that we shall die." Okay, so these things that we take to be rationally true or certain, I mean, are not in fact guaranteed or certain at all, that the sun will rise tomorrow or that we will eventually die. Okay, he continues, "And what is more widely believed?" I mean, everyone says, of course the sun's going to rise tomorrow, of course we're going to die. Okay, and we can jump over to B on page 100. Here Pascal anticipates, so he is ahead of Hume, David Hume's critique of causality are completely valid on the sensory level. The past tells us only the probable, not the certain future. We risk the remote possibility of miracles. Yeah, so Hume's got this whole argument that reason in and of itself is not a good predictor, or reason alone in any case doesn't help us to determine cause and effect, because you can use your reason to imagine any kinds of other effects that might happen given a cause. So like if you think of a pitcher throwing a baseball to a batter, the batter might hit the ball, he might miss the ball might disappear. In hitting the ball, it might evaporate the universe. Okay, reason can come up with any kind of conclusion about what might happen in this brand new novel instance. So reason itself, then, this demonstrates, doesn't show us causality. All right, and then his next critique is that, well, every time I've seen a baseball hit or a baseball thrown, there's a limited number of outcomes. It's hit or it's not hit. Okay, that would be one set. Okay, but the observation also fails to predict, though, what's going to happen, whether the ball will be hit or not. And likewise, just because you see the phenomenon of the ball being hit or the ball being missed doesn't explain like the causation of why that has occurred. So you're just inferring that like causation in your mind, Hume argues. So then this leads to the problem of inference, where Hume says that basically, like, we know that the future will resemble the past, but we have no grounds for knowing that. So how is it that we infer this? And his conclusion is that it's by habituation. Because the sun has dawned every morning for the past, however, but that's not rational, and it's not strictly speaking observation or experience in this narrow sense. It's habituation over time that we just make these assumptions then about the way the world works. Okay, so now you can see how Hume, who obviously is later than Pascal, is anticipated by Pascal, because Pascal's essentially making the same root argument that we're creatures of habit and we live by habit, not by rationality. And so this whole idea that we are rational creatures, again, just proves to be false in another way, so that reason itself becomes a kind of vain tool to understanding reality itself, and of course, truth and morality. Okay, so back to page 99 in the bottom two lines. We're just going to continue. It is then habit that convinces us. We must resort to habit once the mind has seen where the truth lies, in order to steep and stain ourselves in that belief. For it is too much trouble to have the proofs always present before us. This reference down to C.S. Lewis' essay on obstinacy and belief, and also the last page of Miracles. I don't know the last page of Miracles. Obstinacy and belief is just this idea of the 20th century argument of science versus faith. But the connecting point is that no scientist who dismisses Christian faith lives in such a way that he always has to have the proofs present before him. He doesn't sit down in his car in the morning and punch in where he wants to go on his navigational system and sit there and demonstrate proofs for how this is all going to work out and how the technology is reliable and all the physics are constant, so that he doesn't do any of that. He just lives by habit. And so that is, in a sense, then the connection here with C.S. Lewis, who says this whole inflated idea that science has where it poo-poos faith is in and of itself just self-defeating. And also then, likewise, faith is much more substantive than these 20th century, quote-unquote, scientists could reckon. All right, so in any case, it is too much trouble to have the proofs always present before us. Every philosopher, no matter how sophisticated, goes and gets a cup of coffee at Starbucks the same way as you or I. They don't sit around and, like, you know, they might write in their doctoral thesis that there's no such thing as a Starbucks and we have no rational ability to locate that, and yet they just get in their car and go, just like the rest of us. All right, Pascal continues, third line down from the top of 100. When we believe only by the strength of our conviction, and the automaton is inclined to believe the opposite, that is not enough. We must therefore make both parts of us believe. The mind, by reasons which need to be seen only once in a lifetime, and the automaton by habit. Okay, well, a dumb and imperfect analogy to this would be, you can go read online, I mean, just going on the physical thing again, you can go and read online that if you do X amount of exercises and eat X amount of calories for your body weight and your age and everything else, you're going to look amazing in 6 months. Your mind is convinced. The automaton, not so much. And so the automaton has to be convinced by habit. So in other words, you have to actually do the thing and see the thing, and then you'll recognize, okay, these are the results. So not a perfect analogy, but hopefully just makes it a little less headsy here. And then the last line, reason works slowly. Feeling does not work like that, but works instantly and is always ready. Okay, if we drop down to D, the bottom of 100, he wants us to go look at the wager on page 295, but I think that might spoil it, so I don't want to do all that. Once reason has convinced us to believe, we require the aid of good habits to overcome bad habitual tendencies in the opposite direction. So this is kind of hilarious, because, again, reason has to convince us to believe that we require the aid of good habits. Now, we require the good aid of good habits whether we recognize it or not, but then reason has to come along and convince us that it is very reasonable. All right, kind of a hilarious observation if you're so inclined. Therefore, we must act as if we believed, go to church and so forth, thus habituating the automaton to obey what reason has discovered to be true. In other words, if you want to make changes deeply in your being, you have to fake it until you make it. You have to do it before you feel it. And then the feeling comes along next. The rationale comes along next. The, oh, aha, I get it, comes along next. So that is maybe kind of a strange bit of common sense in and of itself that's just lost on us. And that is, you have to actually go out and do the thing before you can know the thing. So habit is much more powerful than reason, would also be a take home. All right, last few lines on the top of 101 before the next pensée. Habit is not an honest substitute for reason, but it is an honest and needed servant to reason. If we try to fight against irrationality with reason alone, we will lose. We need cruder weapons too. So the crude weapon just being a habit or practice. All right, and that, I mean, this is huge. This is biblical reason and wisdom too. So this is why nowhere in the scriptures does it say, wait to do a good work until you feel like it. The secret is you'll never feel like it. So it just says, do what God would have you do. And then as you continue to do that later on, the sort of feelings, like feeling like doing it, the joy of doing it, they come later. So this is why the Small Catechism too uses the language of duty. So you don't wait around until you feel like serving your wife or serving your husband. That will seldom come. You just do it. You don't wait around until you feel like making dinner for your kids or disciplining them. You have to do it because the feeling is quite secondary. So we have duties to which we are called, and that duty written into us becomes habit and then becomes easier and, in general, more enjoyable. I mean, this is also what happens to us unconsciously as parents when it's like sheer raw agony to not have your own time and not be in control of your own schedule and, you know, this, that, and the other. And it does maybe change over time as the kids get older, but it's still present there. What really changes more is you and your attitude toward it. You go from a person who's in control of himself or herself in your own life, and then kids come and show that that's not the case, and gradually you just become okay with that. Gradually you become okay with the fact that the only alone time you're going to get is like from 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock when you're exhausted. Yeah. Okay, so habit and then reason, that is actually how we work psychologically, spiritually, in every way. We are running up against time. We've got 3 minutes. We've got a giant pense. So let's just call it early today, and we'll pick up at 101. How's the pace going for everyone? Are we going too slow? Too in the weeds? Okay. Okay. If you feel like we are, let me know, because I had that thought earlier. Is I could be skipping around a lot more. We could just be flying through some of this stuff with the main points in mind. So as long as you're content with the progress, I'm happy to keep going along at this pace. Let's say then we're going to go 101 to. We'll just say all the way to 114. Doubt we'll get there. But 101 to 114, and then that'll take us to the vanity of the philosophers. The Lord be with you.